All right, welcome to Necromaniacs, episode number 2. I'm here with my brother from another mother.
Yes.
Mike Scandato, and this is Mike Hill.
How you doing, everybody? We are back again. A little longer than a month, but still within the month time frame. We're in late March. It's still as freezing as it was in February.
Yeah, man, I'm over this weather.
Oh, God. Horrible, horrible winter of 2014. But we are back, and just real quick, want to say, got a lot of good feedback on the first episode of Necromaniacs, and I want to thank everybody who checked that out, and hopefully you guys will stick around and continue to check out the further installments.
And also, we're now on iTunes, which is cool.
Yes.
And, so, I mean, you know, thanks for checking out the Podbean post. But you can also download us and subscribe on iTunes. So if you want to go to the iTunes store under podcasts, you can check us out for free.
Cool.
Always free. You know, so you have to ever pay any money, man. This is pure fan-to-fan entertainment.
Oh, totally. We're making so little money from this. No, we're making nothing from this. We're doing it just for the love of movies, of course. And this time around, while venturing a little further out of the straight horror world, we are still under the, I guess, horror sci-fi umbrella, and we will be talking about RoboCop, both the remake for 2014 and the original from 1987.
So just start off, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I mean, right out of the gate, I really did enjoy the new RoboCop with Joel Kinnaman as the star. I was a big Killing fan. That guy really kind of won me over from watching that show. And when I heard he was cast, I actually was very happy. I was like, I can see it. Like, I can physically see him being, you know, the modern RoboCop. And, you know, also when this was announced, you know, the internet and public naysayers were abound, because the original RoboCop from 1987 is a very, very revered film. And I've learned that even more so this year with the release of the new one. But, you know, the new one is not a rated R film. It was a PG-13 film.
That was my original beef when I first saw the trailer for it. I forgot what movie I was watching, but I was in a movie theater. I saw the trailer, and I was like, man, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
Then I did a little research, and I saw that it was not rated R. And I was like, man, I don't know about this. But
yeah, unfortunately, 8 or 9 times out of 10, when the remake goes from R to PG or PG-13, it does not bode very well. But as I was saying, I mean, the original RoboCop, just to say a little about it first, was extremely violent and, you know, sexual overtones and just a lot of sketchy, messed up stuff in it. But in reality, the version you saw back then was edited.
Yeah.
And had even more messed up stuff in it. So, you know, with all that kind of baggage going into the new one, I can see how some people were in with, you know, the folded arms. But I will say it was a fun movie. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it wasn't as grimy as the first one.
No.
Like the original RoboCop just had that grittiness to it. And the new one was more, you know, polished and very well-produced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the acting
great
was like
look
a little bit on
it.
Point. It looked great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also, you know, it updated the character of Alex Murphy by introducing Joel Kinnaman, who you know, also, if any of you watched The Killing, he sort of plays this kind of urban,
yes,
you know, like detective who used to have a drug problem and all.
Right.
You
know. To quote one of my friends, one of my favorite wiggers in the history of wiggers, which is very, you know, it's a very nice quote for the character. While he doesn't really carry that of an, you know, that extreme personification into this RoboCop. He definitely is fantastic at his craft of hiding his accent of his native country.
He's Swedish, yeah.
Yes, he's a Swedish guy. He's definitely up there with, you know, Fassbender as just, you know, a lot of these Europeans who can seamlessly speak just like us.
Yeah. But as far as, you know, getting into the film now, you know, the name Alex Murphy, that's retained.
Mm-hmm.
And the evil corporate empire, OCM,
OmniCorp.
OmniCorp is retained. You know, so and there is this sort of dystopian future world, you know, that this sort of dehumanizing characteristic, which is consistent between the original film and the new film. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, there's that dystopian future world vibe.
Yes, that, it takes
you know, the fighting against.
It's 2028 in the movie. But I will say 2028, well, it doesn't really look all that different from 2014, but that is the date that they, you know, they gave us for the movie. You know, not many flying cars or anything like that. I mean, definitely some, you know, significant changes, obviously, in the look of RoboCop himself and, his overall kind of origin story. In the remake, as opposed to the original, his origin story is him and his partner, another great character actor from HBO, Boardwalk Empire and The Wire, Omar from The Wire, I believe. I cannot think of his
name. I can't remember his name.
I know. We're terrible with that.
But he's awesome.
Yes, he is awesome and he's great. That's his partner on the show. And there are some dirty cops that they are under suspicion of. And the dirty cops don't like how in deep these guys are onto them. And instead of getting blown to bits by bad guys in the original, in the remake, there is a bomb put in his car, in his home. As he's going outside to kind of click off his alarm, the bomb goes off and thus, you know, kicks off the story of how he is chosen to become a RoboCop.
Now, this is where the difference, this is the first thing I noticed, was like comparing it to the original, which is something I really would rather, you know, I mean, I would like to not compare it to the first, but I can't help it.
You know what I mean? Of course.
The brutality in which the first...
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
You know, the brutality in the original with Paul Weller, where they just, you know, like blow him to bits.
Yes,
man,
the Verhoeven film. In the Blu-ray that came out in February of this year, the director's unrated version of RoboCop has that scene even more drawn out. Like, it looks like something out of August Underground, the scene. It's pretty bad on this Blu-ray. I was in shock. Definitely get it. I think I got it for only $9.99 at, like, Best Buy or whatever. But, yeah, it's the unrated director's cut of RoboCop. And yeah, what they do to Paul Weller is insane in the original.
I don't know if you noticed this or not, but one of the henchmen was the guy who played Leland Palmer.
Ray Wise, yes. Yeah, Ray Wise is a henchman. Another henchman is from the original Fame, the redheaded actor who went on to be on one of the medical shows. Either it was Saint Elsewhere or one of those. He is one of the henchmen, and of course the father from that 70s show is the head henchman.
That's right.
So you have a rogues gallery. Dan O'Hurley is the guy from Fame, and Kurtwood Smith is the other character actor, and also we have to mention one of my favorites from the 80s, Nancy Allen from Dressed to Kill. Is the, you know, female partner in the original RoboCop. In this new one, while we don't have the bad guys with so many, you know, recognizable faces, we do have a lot of recognizable faces overall in the film. We have Gary Oldman. We have Michael Keaton, who is, I guess, taking the place of Kurtwood Smith's role, you know, from the original to the remake. And we have Samuel Jackson, who's also in the movie. I mean, there's a lot of good, big-name stars in this film who give, I think, really good performances. But I was telling Mike before we started, I was a little let down that Samuel Jackson's character does not interact with the RoboCop. He's kind of like the, you know, the voice in the Warriors, the female DJ, so to speak, where you don't really... Well, you don't see what she looks like, and you do see what Samuel Jackson looks like. He's just kind of dragging the story along as the host of this kind of right-wing, you know, love America, hate crime, you know, talk show.
What I think is cool about that, too, is, I mean, some of the critics, I guess, have said that the new the 2014 version of it doesn't make as much commentary socially as the original.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I tend to disagree with that because I feel like there is a statement about the media just with Sam Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how reality versus what the media portrays, there's also a heavy spin put on that. And that's kind of what Sam Jackson's character's doing. I mean,
right.
There's this sort of...
he's feeding the public a lot in the movie because basically an important fact is that when the movie kicks off, this, you know, like RoboCop type of initiative is everywhere but America.
Yeah.
And, of course, the crime in everywhere but America has decreased as a result of this, you know, plan. And Samuel Jackson's character, the talk show host, is trying to be like, you know, when is America going to wake up and get with it and allow this bill to pass so that we can have our RoboCop and all our crime can go down. So, yeah, that in a way is kind of like a modern social commentary because a lot of people believe, say, Fox News likes to, you know, stir up all the trouble they can to get, you know, the right-wing constituents all fired up. And, you know, it is kind of – it's its own – you know, it's its own era's commentary.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and like the original maybe was like, you know, speaking out more towards the birth of like reality TV.
Yes.
Know, with, you know, cops. And
mm-hmm. like, yeah, like I was telling Mike, something I thought of the other day, like in 1987, you know, while reality TV was not in full swing, shows like Cops were on and you had the old Morton Downey Jr. talk show. And Geraldo Rivera's show. And you had just kind of a lot of, well, not reality TV shows. You had a lot of talk shows that were getting very out of control and crazy and weird and getting the public very fired up and angry. And that kind of definitely plays into a lot of the original RoboCop. Whereas with the new RoboCop, you have Samuel Jackson's, you know, talking about all the other countries and how America's falling behind and we could reduce our crime if we went with this initiative. And, you know, some people just, I think, hold that original up in such high esteem that it was kind of hard for this new RoboCop, even if it was 10 times better than what it was, the comparison would always just be there.
Yeah, and also, even in the beginning, the opening scenes, there's this, you know, news reporter, newsreel footage of coverage
mm-hmm.
of that sort of paramilitary group,
right?
You know, with a drone and
yes,
you know, like cleaning out some, you know,
mm-hmm.
Middle Eastern, you know, ghetto.
Right. It speaks to our modern day issues of drones and should there be drones and what if these drones are hit the wrong target and things like that, which of course. At the start of the new RoboCop, there's an incident where one of these robots kills a child. And, you know, it's the commentary's there.
You know, and also what also brought to mind was, I don't know if you've ever seen any of those, like, Boston Dynamics big dog videos that are on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically it's the precursor to a RoboCop.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I mean, another thing going through my head watching both of these RoboCops was like, what would it be like? You know, I mean, I feel like the possibility for things to go horribly wrong would be so high that this, I don't know if we'd ever be ready for something like this. I mean, it would be nice, but you know,
yeah.
I think at the end of the day, people want a human being arresting them. I don't know. I mean, at least now, I mean, I could just see things going just so wrong. I mean, as fun as I'd like for it to happen, as someone who obeys the law myself, you know, who you know, generally doesn't really have to worry about these kind of things. I just feel like I don't know if we're ready just yet.
Also, I think in the new film, you kind of go deeper into the reality of, you know, Murphy becoming a hybrid mm-hmm. man machine.
Yeah,
and you know, the sort of emotional conflicts and
right.
You know, just this the whole consciousness trip of him waking up and realizing that he's like mostly mechanical.
Yeah, the new RoboCop definitely plays more into the family side and what happens to this man who was a family man, who had a wife and kid and a pretty good life. And in the original, you get some of that, but it's not as prevalent as it is in the new one. His wife and child are in a lot of the new one, whereas in the other one, the wife is just a few flashback scenes, and it's just really not as important in the original. But I liked the changeup of story. I feel like if you're going to do a remake of something so well known and revered, you have to change it up a bit. Otherwise, what is the damn point, right? Brings to mind music. Glenn Danzig, when he does his covers, he always says that every cover he does, he tries to make sure it is actually never the same as the original. There's definitely some kind of change somewhere in it, because otherwise, what's the point? And I agree. So, you know, especially movies, I agree. I may not always agree in the musical sense, because sometimes I like to hear an artist's straight interpretation of another artist's song. But with movies or even TV shows, case of Walking Dead, I want changes. I don't want the same thing.
Well, on the music side, you know, in Halloween, there's Don't Fear the Reaper, you know, the great Blue Oyster Cult song.
Right.
The track that's in the film is actually another band covering that.
Wow. See?
Yeah.
So I'm surprised I did not know that. Wow. That's interesting. I actually forgot for a while that that song is even in Halloween until this year. I was on a very big Halloween movie kick this year, and I got a Halloween movie tattoo this past year. And I was like, I was even doubting it was in the movie. And of course, yeah, it is in the movie.
Do I have some news I got to tell you? And this might... you know, kind of shine a negative light on me, actually, is the Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, the Gary Oldman.
Yes.
I haven't seen that until about a week ago.
And?
I fucking loved it, man.
You 1992 to
it's
now.
It's been 20-something years.
Wow.
Now, and,
that's a show in itself. Yeah. Well, that could be a Dracula show in itself or a vampire show in itself. But as some people may know about me, I really like that movie, and I have a tattoo of that movie's Dracula on my arm as well. And, yeah, I mean, that movie over time has gotten a bit more respect because a lot of people hated it because of Keanu Reeves. And if you ask me, his iffy acting has very little bearing on that movie. I think it's a great Dracula movie.
He isn't even really in it that much.
Yeah, I mean, so what? His English accent isn't that great. So what? Everybody else, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah.
Winona Ryder's fantastic. Gary Oldman's fantastic. I mean, the music is, to me, some of the best music I've ever heard in any horror film. You know. But anyway, yeah.
I mean, the special effects totally hold up.
Very good.
The creepiness of that whole
thing.
They
are, yeah. No, that movie has become a grower. I mean, it did. Yeah. It was got fairly well reviewed initially when it came out, and over time, it's actually its reputation has gotten bigger and better. And I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. Over the years, though, the thing was whenever somebody would say Bram Stoker's Dracula, I would see Keanu Reeves' face, and I would be like, I don't want anything to do with that movie. Not that I dislike Keanu. I actually think he's kind of cool.
I read up on him and his actual life and the things he's done. He might be like one of the best celebrities out there, but then again, that's a whole other story. The man supposedly gives away 90% of all the money he makes. But anyway, yeah, it is a good movie, and I have like this photo book from it. I have a bunch of memorabilia from the movie. So, congrats, Mike.
Yeah, man, I thought it was awesome. So I feel like whole, you know,
I've somehow completed something
by watching that.
Hey, there are people out there, I'm sure, who saw the new RoboCop that never saw the original. So, hey.
In general, how is it being perceived by people? Like, you know, I haven't really read a lot about it, but what are you know?
Okay, that's the thing. In a way, it's kind of almost like a 50-50, you know? I read some really bad reviews, and then I read reviews that were like, it was a refreshing kind of new take on the 87 movie. And then you would read the reviews where it would be like, it doesn't hold a candle to the 1987 movie. It did pretty well, actually. I know that it came out, let's see, the actual release date was, in America, was February 12th. The budget was $130 million, pretty big, not Avengers big budget, but a big budget, and it made about $250 million. So, It did not bomb, but I don't think it set the world on fire like maybe the studio thought. But it probably will go down as moderately successful. It's not a bomb, not what they wanted. But I do think if they wanted to do it, it did leave it open for a sequel.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, online and on the IMDb boards, there's definitely the movie has some fans. You know, like I said, maybe not what they were looking for, right, with the success angle. But, you know, I really liked it. I can be a tough critic with remakes. I can be a tough critic, you know, with any kind of action PG movie where I, you know, would shake my head at it and not want to watch it. But I went into this one with a really open mind, and I was totally into the story for the whole time, which to me is a big deal, because lately I feel like with new movies going to the theater, I feel like I zone out sometimes, you know, unless it's something I'm really into. And I didn't zone out at all for this movie. So
also, Kinnaman's such a likable guy.
Yes.
You know, he's like extremely likable. Like, I think on both ends, like, I like him. I think he's cool. And like, I know women dig that guy too.
No, definitely. I mean, The Killing put that guy on the map. And he's a big part of that show. I feel like without him, might not have even been as great a show as it was, I would go as far as to say. And I think the guy has a good future in Hollywood if, you know, studios or directors believe in him. I think we've just begun to see this guy in movies, I'd like to say.
Also, one of the indicators that I think they at least were thinking remake, you know, was throughout, you know, his original, you know, mechanism there, his mm-hmm. like original RoboCop, you know, robot body was black, right?
Uh-huh, yes. And at the end, yes, it looks like our original 87 silver, you know, not exactly the same, but a lot like the 87 costume, which was very cool to see. And yeah, it's something we didn't touch on yet. I actually like the fact that his costume was black in the movie, that it wasn't silver.
Yeah,
I liked it a lot.
That sort of tactical, you know, like vibe.
It was, and it you know, comic booky. Like I could see this newer one in its own, you know, in its own legacy, as they say. You know what I'm saying? Like, I like the subtle changes. Especially, you know, not as brutal of an origin, you know, as we talked about earlier, but he was I think they used more human this time, right?
Yeah, definitely.
As opposed to the other one where, Weller's performance, while it was awesome, it left just about zero room for humanity at times.
Yeah.
This one is a lot more humanity. He's actually not happy at all initially to be doing this. He's very tortured. He's very depressed. He's very upset. He misses his family. There really isn't any of that in the original. So,
I mean, yeah, the original one, I mean, you got to remember also it came out, what, 87?
Mm-hmm.
So 86 was the Terminator.
Yes.
So there was like definitely, you know, like some, I think there was that kind of consciousness when it went into like making RoboCop.
Cold. You know, cold. And, yes. Yeah. No, that's definitely, it was a sign of the times. I mean,
yeah.
You know, while the 80s was, for a lot of reasons, was fantastic, for a lot of other reasons, it was a very dark, sad kind of time, violent time. And that, the original RoboCop was a reflection of that. It was, you know, it even had like a sense of vigilanteism within the law world in a way, because he was outside of what the police would normally do.
Yep.
You know, even though he was a cop himself. I mean, that's the thing about the original. There's so many different little angles you can talk about that movie, and it ages very well. I mean, if you check out that Blu-ray, which I highly recommend you go get, there's some great behind-the-scenes footage, and they carried over a lot of the old extras from, like, the 90s DVD, and there's, like, this new material as well. But there's so many things you can touch on. I mean, we barely even touched on the sleaze aspects.
There was nudity. There was nudity in the original. It was topless chicks. And
there's just, you know, like this, I don't know, like this, like the
crime.
The cocaine use, yep, and the doing cocaine off the woman's boobs, and just, yeah, I mean, it was
very, that's, to me, that's the 80s, yes, man. That's like, yes, what the 80s were about. It was just like grimy, like, you know.
Miguel Ferrer doing lines off a hooker. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a wild movie. I mean, I think I forgot how wild it was. I mean, I'm 40 years old. I saw the movie early teens, maybe saw it again at some point in my 20s, but really had not seen it in a very long time. And watching it with new eyes was like, whoa. It was funny, but it was just shocking almost, you know?
Yeah. It was mean-spirited. There was like a nihilism to it. And With RoboCop 2, though, man, like it gets interesting because I actually like the storyline for RoboCop 2. That's the Frank Miller screenplay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
However, the movie itself didn't... It was like, it looked like it was a made for sci-fi, like a sci-fi TV, like right. sort of, you know, like the production, there's something with the production. It just, it didn't really work as well, but the story was so good, man.
Now it's funny, the original RoboCop was a success and made a lot of money and was well reviewed. One would have thought RoboCop 2 would have maybe had a little more respect or a little more put into it. But I agree with what you're saying. I haven't seen it in a little while myself. But I do remember this overall sense of where's the money? Like, what did they put into this movie, you know, to have it stand aside the original great movie? And that was definitely not there. I would agree with that.
It had a very Frank Miller feel, man. Like, the whole, the story, like, you know, there was the main villain, that guy Kane, who probably one of the best villain actors, Tom Noonan. You know, the guy from Manhunter. Yeah,
Tom Noonan, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And has a small role in Heat.
In Heat,
yes, yes.
And also House of the Devil.
Yeah, oh my, that's right. The main, he's the bad guy. Yeah.
The evil guy in House of the Devil.
Yes. Oh, he's a great character actor, too.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and, you know, that it had all the good components, you know, and there's like that crazy like kid, you know, is like murdering people. And, like, they also hint that he like had sex with like that, you know, adult woman.
Right. Well, the sleaze is there. Yeah, it is a rated R film, so you know. But yeah, I mean, I feel like if they were ever to redo Terminator or something, you know, like. Would they want to make it more palatable? I mean, the original Terminator is a rated R movie. I believe Terminator 2 is a PG-13 movie from 1991. I do not think it was a rated R film. I'm almost positive of that. But a pretty violent film, and a very good film, obviously. But I don't know. I feel like sometimes Hollywood wants to scale stuff down and make it so that more people can, you know, jump on board. And that was probably the idea with this RoboCop. And to people like me and Mike, it worked. We enjoyed the movie. And we're people who really generally only like rated R films. I mean, honestly. Yeah. Or movies that are a bit more, you know, grittier and rougher. I was pleasantly surprised at how much I liked the movie. And yeah, this is something I would definitely watch again or get the Blu-ray of and, you know. You know, I'm such a nerd. I bought a figure not the other day. So.
Oh, the new RoboCop.
Oh yeah, it's cool. It's black. Uh-huh. Yeah, I got it on eBay. Pretty cool.
Who made it?
Jada Toys. Jada. Okay. Yeah, and there's a silver costume and a black one, and I got the black one. You can press a little button and the light goes on. You know that whole shit. I love that stuff. You know, the Toys R Us kid. What can I say? So yeah, I mean, I don't know how much the toys sold or how well, you know, how much legs the movie is going to have. I mean, but I do think it was successful in the fact that it was respectful to the original and it was a good update overall. You know what I mean? They didn't go the sleazy route. They didn't go the note for note remake route. So I give them, you know, credit for that totally.
Also, like in the 80s, people that are making horror movies and sci-fi films were definitely gangstery in a lot of ways. Like, they were more, like, on the outside, like, rogue, you know. Like, they knew that there really wasn't, like, that there was an off chance they were going to have any success with it. You know what I mean?
It wasn't like
people that made slasher movies didn't expect there to be, like, you know, this crossover factors.
Right.
You know, but now, because there's a history of... you know, successful science fiction and, you know, horror films. I think that they're looking, they have that angle of like crossing over and making people like, you know, non-horror fans or non-sci-fi fans like get into it. You know what I mean? So I think that is another thing that kind of being from a made in a major, you know, studio, they kind of had that in mind when they made this. And that's kind of a bummer, I think. But but I still, you know, I still like the movie. For a Hollywood film, I thought it was cool. I thought it was good. You know, it kind of takes it and puts it in a different place.
Yeah, know? Yeah. I mean, back then, movies in the 80s, but at some point in the 90s, this changed. Movies opened regionally back then.
Yeah.
And there was several knockoffs for every big blockbuster. And I would say that RoboCop was probably made with Terminator in mind. You know
definitely,
what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
Definitely along those lines, although it was a major studio. It wasn't, you know, an indie film or anything. But, you know, every blockbuster of the late 70s and 80s had 10 to 20 knockoffs. And sometimes these movies were shown in, you know, little places that people have these little memories of actually seeing some of these movies. You know, there are even knockoffs of RoboCop. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah.
if you dig, right, like Man-Borg. Exactly, yeah, you dig, you'll find copies of copies of copies. So today, obviously, it's not the case. It's like, while people do still piggyback on trends, it's definitely not to the extent of what it used to be. I mean, you know, there's we're too busy remaking movies of the 70s and 80s now to be doing that. So, you know, we're almost running out of classic movies to be remade.
Speaking of knockoffs, probably one of my favorite Terminator knockoffs is that movie Hardware.
Oh, yes.
Richard Stanley.
That is a fantastic movie. Yeah. More great cameos with Lemmy and
Iggy Pop.
Carl McCoy from Field of the Nephilim. Yeah, that is a fantastic movie. You can seek out that on Blu-ray and DVD. Great soundtrack, great atmosphere. Yeah, definitely in the family of yeah, Terminator ripoffs in a way, absolutely.
Well, there's a great DVD collection that came out that has, you know, it's the expanded
right,
Dust Devil.
Mm-hmm, yes,
he
yes.
talks about how it actually, he made that film, you know, as a ripoff of Terminator so he can make money to finish Dust Devil.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He actually, this director, Richard Stanley, was also the first director on the Island of Dr. Moreau with yep. Val Kilmer and...
oh, yeah, man.
Oh, my God. I'm, like, totally out of it right
Fariza,
now. Fariza Balak is in it, yes. And one of the last Marlon Brando movies, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, he was asked to leave the set or something, or I don't know. But, no, very interesting guy, and his probably his greatest movie is definitely Hardware. It's something you should definitely check out.
Dude, Fariza Balk, man.
Like, big
always
fan.
Been, always.
The Craft, yeah.
She's great, great.
American History X as the
That was, I think,
Nazi
my favorite,
skinhead girlfriend.
My
yes, yes. She's a very dangerous girl.
She's a very, very...
Mike's a big fan.
Huge fan of hers.
I'm a big Asia Argento fan, Mike. And this week, I have to say, you know, I follow her on Twitter, and she posted something about the Misfits, about Mommy, Can I Go Out and Kill Tonight? And she said something to the effect of, yeah, I got the rights to use that song in my next movie.
Oh.
And I wrote... Oh, that's awesome. You know, on Twitter, I'm a big Misfits fan. You know, what can you tell me about the movie? And then she replied, not really telling me much about the movie. And then it dawned on me that, oh, my God, I just had a conversation with Asia Argento on Twitter, of course. Yeah. So that kind of made my day. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it means absolutely nothing to most people listening. But, man, did it mean a lot to me.
Sure.
It meant a lot, yes.
I wonder what this new thing is.
Yeah, yeah. She's made a few movies already. I mean, they're usually kind of small, artsy, weird films with a lot of nudity, mainly herself naked, which is, again, nothing wrong with that. But, no, she kind of spilled no beans about the new movie, but apparently it will have a Misfits song in it. So that's something you might have heard first today, folks, on Necromaniacs. Follow Asia Argento on Twitter and maybe you'll find out more.
You know, like in just in general, going back to the whole remake idea, I mean, you know, there's been some really, really, really shabby remakes, man.
Yes.
And like, just taking that and putting RoboCop in respective
oh,
of
no.
bad remakes.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Triumph, really, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I just read the other day, next year there's already an Amityville remake already. What about the one from like 8 years ago? I mean, really? Like, is that's getting remade again? That's sad. Yeah. So yeah, there's, and that was a bad one, by the way. Ryan Reynolds was in it. I love the original Amityville Horror. I think it's a great movie. Great music.
Yeah.
Cool classic. Movie. Classic. The remake was pretty terrible, and now they're going to remake it again. So, pointless.
I mean, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre reboots are...
Some people really got behind it. I did not really like it at all. I saw that first one from 2005. I did not see the sequel, which I heard was actually pretty good, but I didn't see it. And then I saw the one from last year.
Texas Chainsaw.
Ooh.
Piece of shit.
Yeah.
Sucks.
But although it is the only one that is a direct sequel to part one, which was a nice idea, but horrible execution.
Yeah.
It was cool that they literally followed up from that day, you know. But it looked like it was, I mean, for the 70s, it looked like the 2000s, and even though it was supposed to be, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, even the scenes in the 70s look like the 2000s, and then it goes up to date, and it just, yeah, that was a mess. I wanted that to be better. I thought it was a mess. The original Texas 2 is still the only worthy, good sequel of all the sequels. The one
with
Bill Moseley's debut, yeah, with Chop Top, and yeah, that's a pretty cool, sick movie. Although some people seem to not like that movie either, but at least I would put that up there as a good part two among all the pieces of crap part twos out there, you know.
I like it. I just, for me, it's all about the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Watching the first one still, you don't think anyone's acting. That's the best part about that movie. It's like, and then when you read about the making of the movie, they kind of really weren't really acting. It was like one of the most hellacious sets ever in movie history, making that movie in 100 plus heat every day, no money, people not getting paid, etc. It looks like it. Watch the movie. That's what it looks like. So
isn't there some new like remaster or something like that of that coming out soon?
Texas, there's a bunch of the DVDs out there, but there's not as many as say Evil Dead, which is the king of the 50 million versions of Blu-ray and DVD. I love Texas so much that I wouldn't even mind a Blu-ray upgrade at this point. That'd be great. I think that'd be amazing. Yeah. I'd buy the hell out of that. I bought last year's Blu-ray upgrade of Halloween, which is a really good one. It was the 35th anniversary last year. So, I've double dipped and triple dipped. I have 4 Last House on the Lefts. I have 2 Evil Deads. I mean, that's a whole other thing in itself.
Yeah, I got like some Region 2 version of Last House on the Left, which some dude sent me.
Mm-hmm.
Cheers to who that guy was.
Yeah, some movies to me are worth double and triple dipping. I bought this RoboCop new one because I had never owned any of the prior ones, and then I just saw the great features on it, and say what you want about Best Buy, that you can't say no to $9.99 for a fully loaded Blu-ray of RoboCop.
Wait, so. you got that for $9.99?
Yeah, I have it in my bag. We'll take a picture. We'll throw it onto the onto the podcast. But I think it was like one of those first week out, specially priced. But it's the unrated director's cut of RoboCop, Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven.
Yes.
A Dutchman.
Yeah.
Also Total Recall and Starship Troopers.
No stranger to great sci-fi.
Yeah.
No.
Well, the guy who did the new RoboCop, this Brazilian, what the hell is his name? Jose...
His name is Padilla? Jose Padilla. Well, Padilla. Yeah. I'll say Padilla, yeah.
I think that this is the first American film that guy's made, I think. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, yes,
most
it
of
was.
His, stuff is Brazilian. Right?
Brazilian, yeah, and as I said before, we were on mic. I would say this was quite a good first feature, first American feature for the guy, and hopefully, definitely see some more work for him. And it was funny. I was just looking online about people who were attached to the remake at some point, and Michael Fassbender was at one point attached. I think he would have been pretty cool in that role. Edward Norton at one point was attached. Sean Penn. Russell Crowe. I have a funny feeling Russell Crowe might have been one of the bad guys. What about you?
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah. And then even as far back as 2011, there was, talk of Tom Cruise or right. Johnny Depp. That wouldn't have worked. I feel like for a movie like this, a major A-lister, no good. I think going with, the Joel Kinnaman was great while he's not completely unknown. He's unknown to, the movie star world unknown. You know what I mean? And obviously, I think they made a great choice.
Yeah, also, the killing is still, it's pretty fringe, really.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's not people know about it, but it wasn't a huge major hit.
No, it's canceled, brought back twice. So, it goes down in history for that alone.
And season 3 is Netflix only, right?
Or season see, it's funny,
4
it's,
or something, whatever season it is.
Well, if you go, the first season, which upset so many people because they didn't, get the killer, so to speak. I count that as season 1. The second season, which is a part 2 of that original, is season 2. Season 3 was The New Case, which was on, last year on TV. And I believe this new season 4, but third story, is going on Netflix, if I'm not mistaken, or Amazon, or one of the other new ways to see a TV show. I can't think right now.
I'm all about that, man. This whole streaming world where you don't need TV anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's how we brought you Here Comes the Devil, which was, there was no disc of it. I think it was in Manhattan for a moment, but yeah, you were able to see it on, iTunes or Amazon, I think it's a great way to get a movie out there. I mean, for a while, Kevin Smith's Red State was not in theaters at one point. It was, it came after the fact. And I'm starting to wonder what the hell's going to happen to, Eli... Eli Roth's new movie, Green Inferno, which has been done for several months. It screened once in Manhattan on some kind of festival night that I missed, and now I have no idea when this movie's going to come out or if it's going straight to DVD or whatever. I have no idea.
Is that supposed to be his sort of,
His cannibal? Yes. Well, he got the title from the movie within the movie of Cannibal Holocaust, The Green Inferno. That's the name of the movie that the people are shooting in Cannibal Holocaust. So yeah, he took it from there, obviously. And he admits it. It's not, no secret, but I'm dying to see that damn movie. So hopefully it hits a theater. It would be nice,
Did you happen to catch that Netflix, produced horror series, Hemlock Grove?
I watched the first episode only and I did like it, but I never went back. So it's something I think about going back to.
Yeah.
But I know you watched the whole thing and you
banged it out one weekend.
Wow.
It was one of those times where I had absolutely nothing going on and I just knocked it out, marathon.
Awesome.
Grinder style. It was good, but it was too many. It felt too long. There was definitely a lot of fat that could have been edited out of that thing. But I thought, in general, it was pretty interesting. And there was, some, weird Circle of Ouroboros, expanded consciousness.
Okay, I can get into that.
Things going on, which I thought was kind of cool.
Cool. Well, it's good that you touched on TV or TV-ish horror, because a show that blew the pants off me and Mike was... And not necessarily a straight horror show either, is True Detective on HBO, which was on this winter. And I tell you, it made for some of the best 8 hours of TV viewing I've ever seen. And I mean, I know everybody's kind of, all on the jock of the show and everything, but for me personally, worth the hype, worth the praise, worth the jocking.
Yeah, man, totally. I mean, that just took everything to a new level. And the fact is, for a minute you thought it was going to go in like the supernatural world, man. And like, you're like, wow, what's this all about, man?
And I told Mike this, the amazing thing about this show, it's like you knew it was a hit when by like episode two, you had 100 conspiracies out there. You had fan sites out there. You had Facebook groups out there by two episodes, three episodes. And that is just like, that doesn't happen to every show a few episodes in. Let's be honest. That just simply does not happen. But this show was so ripe and loaded with things to talk about and just these signs and these references. And it was just unbelievable. It was like a perfect storm of like drama, crime, horror, fiction, you know, this whole thing rolled into one, you know, and it's just unbelievable.
By now, everyone's seen it. You know,
I mean, yeah, so like, I mean, you
no,
know what?
There's no spoilers, but well, so we're just going on.
Yeah, about here's your disclaimer. We're giving spoilers, okay? Yeah. If you haven't watched any of True Detective, which you really should have, you probably should not listen to the remaining moments of this podcast because we're going to talk pretty much about it from, you know, all the secrets and whatnot. Yeah. But anyway, I remember hearing about this show. It was going to be on HBO called True Detective with Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. And you know what the first thing I thought was? I thought it was a comedy, Mike. Because you know why? Because it had Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Yeah. I didn't really know what it was going to be. And then, of course, some time went on. And no, it's not a comedy. It's a drama. And then the little snippets were showing up on HBO and in between the shows that they were showing and brief trailers, and I'm like, ooh, this looks pretty dark. I remember it's the first thing I told a friend of mine, I'm like, wow, this looks like it's going to be really dark. And that's just, I mean, saying it's really dark does not justify how dark the show was.
I didn't even figure out what it was, literally, until the day that it aired. You know, I watched it on HBO Go. Because I don't, you know, I don't have cable or anything like that. But I saw a bunch of billboards in the subway for it.
Yeah.
And you know, initially I didn't think it was a comedy, but I actually thought it was a movie until I actually paid more attention to like, okay, it's on HBO, so it means I could check it out on HBO Go. And man, it got the hooks in that first episode.
Yeah, I mean, it premiered January 12th, and you know, in the today's day and age of not 16, not 12, not 10. We got only, unfortunately, 8 episodes of this one. But, you know, it was the hit of the winter. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty much all anyone was talking about on my Facebook. And, you know, I've run the gamut of different types of people I'm friends with on Facebook and people I follow, and as well as on Twitter. And at the end of that first episode, it kind of really, really started. It was created and written by author Nick Pizzolatto. And this is the guy's first foray into television. He's a
crime writer.
Crime writer, yeah. And yeah, this show, one of its many angles, is definitely a good crime story.
Absolutely. Yeah, Pizzolatto wrote a book called Galveston. Which, you know, once I started getting into the series, you know, I started ordering all these books. You know, I ordered Galveston, I ordered The King in Yellow, which a lot of the imagery and symbolism and, you know, naming, you know, the names that they throw around, like Carcosa, like the Yellow King, all that stuff's, you know, from that book.
One thing worth mentioning is that this time around, it's a first for HBO for a while, or maybe ever, is that this is an anthology series where it's pretty much a self-contained season. Season one is the first story, and that's it. And when it's over, that's all she wrote for that particular story. So it's going to follow in the footsteps of American Horror Story.
Yeah.
I think initially they did want maybe some of the characters, not the characters, the actors from the first season to go into the second season. But this is pretty much looking like I don't think any of the actors are going to be involved in the season two story of True Detective, which is TBD. They've given very little information about it. But Nick Pizzolatto did say something very interesting, that it had to do with the occult and the birth of the railroad. Did you read that?
No.
Yeah.
That's what he said about the second
season? About the second season, yes. About the birth of the railroad and the occult.
Well, you know, our country has been, you know, there's a lot of Masonic.
Right.
You know, the Masons are pretty heavily into sacred geometry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a cult doesn't necessarily mean witchcraft. It just means hidden.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So maybe that's really what he's getting to, is that there's some sort of, you know, similar to season one, you know, secret society.
Uh-huh.
Maybe, you know, the railroad business, you know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe this is taking place in the 1800s.
Right, I don't know. Yeah, it's very, again, don't know. He didn't say any time about time frame or anything.
Yeah.
But, I kind of can see in my head maybe what that kind of means. You know, a lot of people are like, what the hell does that mean? I kind of get it. So, yeah. Our American history is rooted in a lot of secret, hidden, you know, shit. I mean, look at the Freemasons alone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of stuff out there for a good writer or a writer who has any kind of knowledge of that stuff to incorporate into a show. I mean, absolutely. But you touched on The King in Yellow, and The King in Yellow, yeah, it came from Robert W. Chambers from 1895, and most interesting thing about this guy is, number one, he was a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Number two, he was one of H.P. Lovecraft's favorites and biggest influences. So that's how, you know, how far back this is going. And it was also kind of like the idea of the story within the story, about how, you know, the King in Yellow was this entity that was a part of another story that, you know, I'm trying to phrase it as good as I can, but I kind of like how in Cannibal Holocaust, there's the movie within the movie, you know, and in Blair Witch, there's the movie within that, like they're trying to film something for that. Well, yeah, The King in Yellow is similar to that, where it has to do with a book that's kind of cursed.
It's a play, yeah.
Right, it's like a cursed play. I'm sorry, that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, how many writers have the balls to do that? to pull that up from you know, obscurity? I think it was great. But the other thing is, you had said in the first few episodes, people really didn't know what to make of it. And people were kind of convinced that this King in Yellow was like a monster, or like there was going to be some type of hugely supernatural element to the show. While there was a slight supernatural element to the show, Nick Pizzolatto has said that, no, you know, he in his mind, it's a very human and, you know, believable story, and believable things happen. You know what I'm saying? The supernaturalness is just kind of like in the air. It's in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's Louisiana.
It's like this energy.
It's a cult. It's just, yeah, it's just all these little kind of things that kind of make the stew, as they say. You know what I mean? And I mean, for people like myself and Mike, who just like that shit so much, this show was just like, why? It was just like tailor made for people,
oh, yeah,
you know, like us. You know what I mean? I mean, I'd love to see a rip off of True Detective at this point. I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. Yeah. Believe me. But I'm just really excited about, you know, the future of the show. But we can talk a little more about the show itself.
Yeah, the it's funny when you mentioned the comedy aspects to it. The Woody Harrelson, though, you know, a lot of his work is comedic.
Mm-hmm.
He played a pretty straight dramatic role in that movie Rampart.
Yes, he was great in Rampart.
Characters similar, very similar character.
Yes, kind of more veiled racist than this, whereas he's more outward racist than the Rampart.
And he's kind of a piece of shit.
Yeah,
you know, like
Two-Time's
wife, you know, he's like, I don't know, a cad.
And another great dramatic role, People versus Larry Flint, although there's a lot of comedy in that, but it's drama. And, of course, he's in No Country for Old Men. So he's no stranger to serious, but most people generally, I think, in their heads, you pop him into your head and you think of comedy, like I do. I think of Cheers. So, but man, he's amazing as a drama actor.
And also McConaughey too. He was in a movie called The Paperboy, I think it was called, where he plays this. It's like it's got like John Cusack in it. He plays a reporter who is in the South, And, you know, he's like, he's gay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a pretty dark movie. He plays a really intense character. You know, and also a movie, Frailty, he was in that.
Yeah.
Where he, that's got Bill Paxton in it.
Oh, absolutely. And I could see Bill Paxton in True Detective as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, man, totally. You know? Yeah, he plays like, you know, it's like a pretty straight up character, you know, dramatic role. Not really any comedy in that one at all, you know?
But this has been McConaughey's year. I mean, between this show, and he had a fantastic small role in Wolf of Wall Street, which was, he kind of stole the scene. Oh, he has kind of like a scene stealing movie there. And then for Dallas Buyers Club, which he won the award for. Wow. I mean, what a career turnaround. I always thought he was a pretty good actor. Sure, I didn't like any of the freaking romantic comedies he did, but I liked him. I mean, I guess I liked him from, you know, the Dazed and Confused, yeah, 20 years ago. Great. You know, I thought he was great in that. And, I mean, you know, sure, a lot of actors, they take a while to get out of the rut of the type of style of movies they do. And in his, it was bad romantic comedy. So.
Well, he was also in that movie that came out in the 90s. It was him and Christian Bale. It was like a movie in the future where they were these, you know, fucking dragons or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the name
God.
Of that film.
Yeah, I didn't see that movie, but yes. Yeah, that was, it was like a fantasy sci-fi film.
It was decent. You know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was no Game of Thrones, for sure, but it was pretty good, you know, I thought. And, you know, once again, he played a pretty straight-up dramatic role. There was no real humor in that movie. He was playing opposite Christian Bale, who, if you're going to play opposite Christian Bale, you got to be a bad motherfucker.
You have to step up your fucking game, yeah. Oh, Paperboy, I do want to see. And a movie he's in with a dramatic role, I did not see it. I heard it is pretty sick. Killer Joe.
Ah, yeah. I saw that one,
too.
Oh,
you did see that. That was great. I got to see that movie. I hear all these great things about it.
It's offbeat, that one. It's a good, you know, that's homeboy there. Paul Schrader.
And, oh, the movie we're talking about is Reign of Fire.
Reign of Fire.
Which I never saw. Now I want to see it, actually.
It's worth it, dude. I thought it was, you know, it's a fun movie. It's in the future. There's dragons. There's, like, you know, people, like, fighting dragons. It's always good when you got dragons and, you know, fire, destruction, and shit like that. It's like one of those movies, you know. And Matthew McConaughey plays this guy who's American, you know. Most of the movie takes place in England. And he's like this American ass-kicker, dragon slayer guy. So, yeah. But one of the things about True Detective, which I thought was like, the story itself was awesome, but the things, the loose ends, the things that they hint at that were never resolved in that.
Oh, yeah. I still think about to this day.
Me too, man. Equally as compelling.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things of it, you know, let's face it, a big chunk of this was about, you know, child molestation. It was about, you know, murder. It was about a lot of heinous stuff. But child abuse in general was one of its themes. And the daughter, well, the girl who plays the daughter of Woody Harrelson's character, kind of acts out sexually at a young age. And there's a scene where Matthew McConaughey goes past her room, and there's a female doll laid on the floor with five male dolls surrounding her, and the doll is naked. And then there's a scene, of course, where Matthew McConaughey is being interrogated, and he makes those five figures out of the plastic, beer cans, and they're also arranged in a similar fashion. And then, of course, we learn about the five horsemen who were a part of the, you know, the cult, who were abusing children and murdering girls, as we find out. This is kind of resolved, but not really. We don't get to find out who these five people were exactly. And if you really watch the show and you pay attention to, say, the first three episodes, a character who is definitely not right is Woody Harrelson's father-in-law. And there's just some of those moments he talks about, you know, these kids today, like these kind of lines that I guess mean nothing initially when you first watch it, but then once the show is all over, they take on another life. And you get to pay attention to how the daughters were around the home of their grandfather, and some of the, even the things the grandmother says, and about relationships, mm-hmm. and about men, and there's just this whole weird vibe that something is not right there. Would you agree, Mike?
I totally agree. And also, there's a scene, you know, where there's like a time slip in there. I forgot mm-hmm. what episode it happens, where the young girls are kids.
Mm-hmm.
She throws that crown and it gets stuck in the tree.
Yes, as if you are, you're no longer... The symbolism I read into that is like she's no longer a princess. Like she's.
But
no
also
longer,
the kids that mm-hmm. are getting abused, they're getting murdered, mm-hmm. wearing crowns too.
Yes, there's so many. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just two, and I bet you there's more behind what some people might have read into that scene.
Yeah.
But absolutely, absolutely. You know, don't want to jump ahead too much, but that doesn't really get resolved. And we don't know if that was supposed to get resolved. But it is something that is like, oh, man, well, what about this, you know? Because time goes on and, you know, Woody Harrelson gets divorced from his wife. He's, you know, many infidelities with smoking hot women on the show, which is just, oh, God. Anyway.
He's a private investigator.
Oh, yeah, he becomes private investigator. Yeah. And... yeah, it's never really mentioned again. The daughter's bizarre behavior. She has like a threesome with older guys when she's only like 15 or whatever. These things are kind of swept by the wayside because they're really so hot on the case. And it's really, you know, the show's, you know, the crux of the story was more about solving this case. But it is almost frustrating as you know, if you're like a super fan or someone who notices things, to have all this stuff go by the wayside. But then again, I'm almost used to it with The Sopranos and, you know, other shows where all these great could have been things. But this is a little different because I think it was a real part of the story. And it is a part of the story. It's just that we don't know if Woody Harrelson's daughter was abused or not. We have no idea if she was abused. I think she was as a viewer of the show. But there was no confirmation that she was abused.
And also, I think it sort of reflects, like, true police work, too. I mean, you know, you and I both, I mean, I know I've spent the good better part of the 1990s reading about serial killers.
Yes.
And, you know,
me
true
too.
Crime.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and, you know, you read the police report version of, you know, catching some of these guys, and but there's all the stuff that you never know about.
Mm.
Like, the victims that they killed that you never, you know, just unknown people that maybe weren't even missing yep. by anybody, missed by anybody. And this beckons back to that where, like, you know, the reality of fight of being a criminal investigator, you catch a guy, you know, you probably haven't gotten everything nailed, but you got that, you know, for sure you got one guy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the, I guess maybe one of the big, you know, points that the show is trying to make, that in police work, a lot of times, like, you know that there's more out there, but you can only get the one guy that you know about, you know?
Well, yeah, this case haunted, you know, Russ Cole and Marty Hart for about 20 years. The show kicks off in 1995, and I will say this, they did a very good job of 1995. It's kind of hard to do 1995, but they did it in a great way. There's no cell phones. There's pagers.
Uh-huh.
The way they dressed and the hair was definitely 1995. Another very cool thing was that they had Woody Harrelson wearing a Division Bell Pink Floyd shirt. That album came out in the summer of 94. oh, yeah. I'm very – movie people, hire me for your continuity guy. I will make it look like whatever you want me to make it look like. And another interesting thing was in the police station in the 1995 scenes, no computers on the desks. And then as it jumped a little later into the 90s, they had the big-ass computers on the desks. And then in the 2012 scenes, you had the smaller, you know, desktop one, like the very, you know, 2012-looking ones. There was no corners cut on continuity, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, this case haunted them from 1995 to 2012. It haunted Matthew McConaughey's character so much so that he kind of never recovered. Like
no.
He kind of stayed in a suspended animation in a way. Woody Allen's character kind of moved on. He divorced. He got kind of like fatter, right? Yep, as you see,
lost some weight.
But Russ Cole was a haunted man. You see, according to society at large, they did get the killer. It was two people who were responsible.
Well, those two guys that looked like that. One dude looked like he was in Goat Horror.
Oh, yeah.
That fat dude.
And man, they had some really great biker extras and tattooed freak extras. Yeah. I mean, very, very great convincing character actors all across the board on this show. But
there's some Melvin's tracks.
Yes, there's Melvin's track, and I believe a sleep track at some point. Yeah. I believe sleep, yes.
When they're in that dingy, like, crystal meth, like, biker.
Yes.
Haven.
There's a point in the show at the midway where, the case is quote-unquote solved. But Russ never really believes that, and he's right, of course. They did not get all the people responsible. One scene, which was almost better than the Heat bank robbing scene from 1995, was the scene in the projects kind of area.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm. It's like this single shot scene with Matthew McConaughey going through this house. Oh my God. I cannot wait to like watch that on Blu-ray and watch that again. Mm-hmm. That was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen on TV in my life. And if you saw the show, you would probably know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, I was just glued to the TV with like my mouth open during that whole tense scene.
There are several things about that scene that I liked. Was that, you know, first when he goes undercover, right, and he infiltrates his former, he had a relationship with those guys initially.
The bikers, yeah.
And the head guy looks like my friend Morgan from the singer from Kill the Client. He looks like my buddy Morgan.
During that whole episode, there's a few people there. I'm like, isn't that, I know that guy. But anyway,
But the thing it was impressive to me was like, how the bikers are like, you know, we're these bad motherfuckers and like, you know, we don't know about you. But then when it really came down to the reality of combat, those guys folded, man.
Oh, yeah.
Hard.
Oh, totally.
And,
I mean,
Russ Cole pulled their ass out of the
Russ Cole is probably the quickest legendary TV character ever. The man went from no one to legend in 3 months in 2014. It's like, when was the last time that's ever happened ever in TV? Like,
it's a great name, too. Man.
It is a great name.
Rust Cole.
I mean, I want to read Rust Cole novels. I want to see more of this guy. I mean, you know, it's like there's so much to talk about this show. As far as the horror supernatural angle goes, it was, you know, pieces borrowed from, you know, Chambers and just that overall atmosphere of dread and terror from Lovecraft. It was just very, like, prevalent on a TV show. You know what I mean? It was like, you actually thought maybe there is a supernatural being in the swamps of Louisiana. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That was a complete possibility throughout most of the show. No? I mean, a lot of viewers thought that's what was going to happen. I myself thought that might be what was going to happen. So, you know. There's not a lot of that on TV today, and that's another reason that made the show so special, you know?
Well, the thing that was kind of Lovecraftian in some ways was the whole Carcosa element at the last episode.
The last episode, yes, absolutely.
You know, like a lot of times in Lovecraft's fiction, you know, there's like a modern human encampment or whatever. They're camped out at the ruins of some ancient civilization that may or may not be human or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that when we catch up with Errol and his sister there making flowers.
Yes. Now, Errol is, you know, spoiler up the ass. We find out that this one particular quote-unquote, you know, monster that some of these people were referring to was a man with a lot of scars on his face, a big guy. And we actually saw this guy, was it episode 2 or episode 1? I think it was episode 2, might have even been episode 1. We see him. He's the man mowing the lawn at the rundown school. As it turns out, we don't see any scars on his face because we only see half of his face in that scene.
Yep.
And then the more genius, I think, from Nick Pizzolatto and just the people behind the show, whereas Evil was looking at you in the face in the sunlight and you didn't even know it. But anyway, we do catch up to this guy at the end of the episode, and man, oh man, what a nutty and amazing character this turns out to be. He's watching old movies and speaking in a British accent and just kind of like
banging
prancing around the house, banging his half-sister, I believe, and just, man, I mean, this disgusting. The house was kind of like an update of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, right?
Absolutely. Very much so, man.
Very much so. Even just as creepy, if not worse. But aside from that, he lived on this farm property, which was the scariest fucking farm property I've ever seen, with this outhouse, with the father, tied to the bed, kind of half of dead, and all these sick paintings and drawings everywhere. And then as you go into the field, you get to see Carcosa, this literal city that this man built.
Yeah, like a ruin of some past.
Oh, my God. It was unbelievable. It was just so great to see this.
And that's when I really got on it. I'm like, that's the Lovecraftian sort of vibe.
Yeah, totally.
And then it's like, you know, your mind goes into these places where it's like, well, maybe there's this, like, you know, energies, dark energy manifesting in this, like, old ruin. And that's what's creating this whole thing.
Who has ever done this on TV? Yeah, there have been very gritty crime shows. There have been, you know, horror shows on TV. But who's taken an hour-long drama and threw this into the mix? It's never been done before. And it was great, and it worked. I mean, I just, you know, the bar is so high for season two. But to me, the floodgate is open for maybe just this kind of drama, this kind of television. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, why not? I think people love that element of the show.
Well, what I love about this sort of format is that, you know, you go to a movie, you got 90 minutes, 2 hours or something like that. But with, you know, like 8 episodes, you have, you know, 8 hours of this, like, palette to paint this, like, picture. You know what I mean? And you really can get deep into it and go really detailed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like what I love about it, you know?
Twines is climbed up slowly towards the
So, Mike, have you been keeping up on Walking Dead?
I have been keeping up, but this season has been, I don't know, I think True Detective, I mean, it's kind of unfair to compare the two, you know, some could argue, but I just feel like that held my interest so much more that Walking Dead would be my secondary show, and I would just, I don't know, there's a few episodes I thought were really bad and very slow-paced and just a pale, you know, shadow of the earlier seasons and other episodes. And, you know, I would express this on my Facebook page, and some people would just attack me. Walking Dead has become a show that is basically, to certain portion of its fans, infallible. And a show that you can't say a damn thing about unless it's praise. And I think that's silly. But, and some people who are hearing this may disagree that, no, it's not. But no, yeah, these people are out there. You can't say a word of negativity about the show. And I think that gets kind of annoying. But anyway, I think True Detective stole some of its thunder from me. I watch it, but I haven't watched it like I used to watch it in the past. And I honestly think that there's a part of me that is losing interest. And the only thing I could think of is because I feel like I've seen this song. I've heard this song before. I've seen this movie before. And it's just, you know, I don't know. The excitement, I don't think, was there for 90% of the season for me.
Yeah. The thing is, I recently introduced my parents to Walking Dead, mm-hmm. like the TV show, and we watched the entire first season over the weekend.
Which is a fantastic thing to watch. It's great.
And the juxtaposing the first season with the new stuff, I'm like, man, like the first season was a smash, dude. It was awesome. And
yeah.
Though I do watch it. I look forward to seeing every episode. I'm really, you know, I enjoy it. It's not nearly as good as it started out.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
And most shows for whatever season's in generally aren't. Some shows get better, you know. It's usually some sitcoms that get better over time. Usually dramas, you know, it's not always the case where you're going to get that much excitement. But I do understand about pacing and about letting things unfold. But I feel like the post-prison landscape has just been a little, maybe too slow and maybe a little too disappointing for me. I am a reader of the comic and a big fan of the comic. And I, two seasons ago, threw off any kind of more, you know, notions of, oh, it's going to be like the comic a long time ago, maybe more than two seasons ago. And you can't mimic the comic that much. Otherwise, everyone will know what's coming at every turn and it'll suck. I do like some of the changes they've made and some of the new people and new characters and new ideas. But I don't know, maybe I think it's just the overall execution of some of these things that is not really sitting well with me. And I feel like maybe the writers this year are trying to flex their verbal muscles and just reminding us, well, this is a drama. Maybe a little too much this year. Or just giving certain people too many speeches this year. I don't know. It's just something about it. There have been some great episodes, but they were more in the first half of the season, I think, than in this half of the season.
Well, the last two episodes I thought have been pretty good. There's the one with the kids, you know, mm-hmm. those two young girls.
Yes, that was the highlight yeah. of this second half.
That was very powerful, I thought. And then at the end of this last season, you know, they go to Terminus, mm-hmm. which is a fucked up name for a place that's supposed to be the safe haven, I think.
Yes, a sanctuary. It sounds like where you go to die.
Yeah, Terminus. You know, it's like if I saw a town called Terminus, I think I'd try to avoid that place.
Yeah, I'd turn around.
Yeah. But there's this sort of, you know, vibe at the end of this last episode where, you know, okay, you know, we're here. You know that shit's not going to be what it appears to be. You know,
right.
Some, like, nice hippie lady cooking some food.
Yeah, you know? Nah, there's more to it, I'm sure.
Yeah. My prediction is that it's going to be a sort of hybrid of some of the things that were going on in the comic book. You know, like the cannibal group, maybe.
Yes, I've said many times that the best story arc has yet to be shown from the comic on the TV show, which was the, I believe, No Way Out cannibal storyline. And I actually thought that this season would have been the season for that, if there was even going to be a season for that. But, Mike, you could very well be right. They could maybe, instead of, again, copying something that everyone knows what's going to happen, incorporate it into something new, and perhaps maybe this Terminus is it. I would be very happy with that. And I will say this, Walking Dead always ends well.
Yeah.
Ends its seasons very well. Usually the last two episodes are very good, and particularly the last episode of all the seasons has been very good.
Right.
And, of course, I read today somewhere online that Kirkman said, oh, yeah, it's going to be a doozy episode. So, yeah, I have no idea what's going to happen. But as you said, the murder, you know, the little blonde girl, you know, fiasco, as I called it, that was probably the highlight of the second half. But it had to be done. Some people were like, I can't believe they killed the kid. No, it had to be done. That girl was a monster. I mean, she letting her live would have been a far greater crime against humanity than killing her.
No, I agree. You know, and yeah, I mean, there's, you know, like similar to the comic too. Even the comics. So, I mean, I've been on board with the comic for, you know, pretty much from day one.
Yeah.
And it has its peaks and valleys too.
Totally.
And I think that Kirkman's looking at the long view with his screenwriting. You know, I think that there's like a long view with the series, and yeah, there's going to be lulls and action and characterization, and it's whether or not you enjoy that aspect of it. It's like, you know, I thought it got a little long winded too.
Yeah,
you know, but I still have faith in Kirkman's writing and, you know, his direction and, you know, where he wants to go with this.
What about the talk of spinoffs? I gotta be honest, I don't want to see that. I think it'll make the main show worse in some respect.
No, I agree.
I don't know if they've completely greenlit the spinoff or not, but
what's the spinoff of
I can't even
Merle?
Remember. Yeah.
I would be into
well,
that. Well,
no, actually, I'm not even sure if it is, but there's already talk of it. But no, I don't like that at all. I mean, I'm more excited about the several other comic properties that are coming down the pike, including the Batman one with the, you know, the early days of Bruce Wayne and the early days of you know, the Gotham PD. That looks pretty cool. The
similar to what Batman is now,
right? Right. Well, yeah.
You know, Batman comic is they sort of rebooted it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a young Bruce Wayne,
right?
You know, kind of like, you know, coming into his own. He just comes back to Gotham. So is that what this it's a TV series?
Yeah, well, I believe, though, this one is he's going to be a child. And it's going to focus more on Dent and Gordon and, you know, like, I think, like, just really, like, early days of the Batman family. And then, of course, the Constantine show, which the stills and pictures I've seen of it look really good. Whether or not the show was really good remains to be seen.
Playing Constantine?
Oh, British actor. I can't think of his name. I'll have to look it up. But, you know, we can definitely have a whole podcast on the future of all of these upcoming properties, you know, comic book property shows and movies. I saw a great picture today of Scarlet Witch for the new Avengers. Elizabeth Olsen. Very nice looking woman, playing Scarlet Witch. She looked great, and an image of Quicksilver, and a very, you know, brief image of what looked like Ultron looked kind of cool.
Ah.
So yeah, I mean, Marvel's got a lot up their sleeve, and it's funny. Do you watch Arrow?
You know what? I mean, it's,
everybody's telling me to watch
it. I've been meaning to check that out.
I gotta jump in, man. Yeah. I gotta watch it. I hear that there's a lot of great characters on it, and there's.
Is it actually Oliver Queen?
Oh,
right
no, yeah. Oh, his name's Oliver Queen, yeah.
Okay.
I believe this is in the midst of season two now.
Oh, okay.
But no, I heard there's a lot of great characters on it, and it's cool to watch as a DC fan. So, going off on a tangent there.
So, you know, I'm not really a DC fan. I like a couple of things.
I think I am a DC guy. Yeah. I guess I'm both, But I almost probably skew more DC than Marvel these days. But I'm very much looking forward to Marvel's 4 Netflix series that are coming out next year. They're doing an original Daredevil, an original Power Man, original Iron Fist, and I forget the fourth one.
Power Man and Iron Fist separate or together?
Separate.
Weird.
It's a Luke Cage, Daredevil, an Iron Fist, and I can't think of the fourth one right now.
Who's playing Luke Cage?
Oh, they didn't announce any of that yet, but Netflix struck a deal with Marvel, and there's going to be 4 original series, live action series, all shot and set in New York.
Well, yeah, it's Marvel.
Isn't that great? Yeah, that's pretty cool. Huh?
Yeah, Marvel is... That was one of the things I liked about Marvel, is that took place in a real city.
Yeah, I know.
You know, Peter Parker is from Queens, you know, mm-hmm. like... The Punisher is from Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Punisher might be that fourth one, by the way. Just kind of slipping my mind.
If they can only fucking get the Punisher right, man.
They've gotten portions of the Punisher right in portions of, like, I actually thought Thomas Jane was a decent Punisher, but it was a horrible movie and a horrible script. I actually thought Dolph Lundgren's Punisher was good, but back then they didn't know what they were doing and he wasn't even in the goddamn costume. But the movie itself was pretty good. It's like there are these snippets of Punisher that have been out there that have been good. I don't know if Punisher is good for regular TV. I think it is good for the Netflix pay TV. Like if it can be envelope pushing, it can be good on TV Punisher, I think. You know? Like a CBS Punisher? No. That wouldn't work.
You know, or AMC. You know.
Yes, that could work. Yeah. Or, you know, Fox. FX.
My opinion would put, like Sons of Anarchy style. If they went in that direction or, you know, or Justified, like in that trip, mm-hmm. you know. My thing with the Punisher is, like, I think that you almost need to approach it like, you know, gritty crime. And for a television show or a movie, I would even say you don't even need the costume. You just put a guy in a black army jacket with boots and, like, a couple of guns.
I kind of get that.
You know? I mean, I know that that's like a little bit of a bold statement because like it's so iconic with his like skull.
The skull,
something more subtle, you know.
Right, or smaller, or just some. I know, just saying, like you could be quite an ass-kicking vigilante in, say, you know, a black army jacket and pants and your bulletproof vest and your gun belt and well, sure, you know, the Punisher could be just as effective, but I think when you slap on that skull onto the black. It just takes it to another place.
Yeah, you go to another level with that thing, yeah.
Speaking of costumes, we're on a brief superhero tangent. I loathe Spider-Man's movie costume. I don't like it.
Ever? Like all of them?
No, this current one. The one that was in Amazing.
The emo one?
Man, it doesn't look good. It just looks so weird and like something like they, you know, found at a costume shop. I don't know. I thought Tobey Maguire's one looked great.
Yeah.
I didn't think twice at that. At no point did I watch it and go, that costume looks terrible. It looks wrong. There's just something so wrong about the current Spider-Man costume. Take a look at it and tell me if you don't think that it just looks like poorly constructed and goofy looking. It looks goofy. I don't know. It's weird.
I haven't fucked with the new movie yet.
Yeah, I didn't even get to finish The Amazing Spider-Man, and I didn't really like it that much. The new one, I think it looks terrible. I'm sorry. It looks like the part 3 all over again with, like, way too many villains in the mix. And it just, I don't know. Some people are like, oh, no, give this Spider-Man a chance. And I'm like, I don't know, man. 2002 and 2005 weren't even that long ago for me to give another Spider-Man a chance in 2014.
Raimi.
Exactly. The Raimi one was good.
Perfect, I thought.
And I know they had to, for legal reasons, whatever, to keep the franchise going or whatever stupid political reason they had to make the new Spider-Man. But I don't like the way it looks at all. So, and that takes away from it. If a costume sucks, it's really going to take away from it for me.
You know, man, like getting back to the Punisher real quick, if they approached it almost like a Breaking Bad type show or something like that, where it was like...
Make it a little more believable. Right. Look, we know the Punisher, Frank Castle, was a Vietnam veteran. But, well, you know what? Vietnam was almost 40 years ago. Yeah, so we can just take that out of it, make it Desert Storm. Like, there's things you can do. You can even get rid of the veteran thing and still make it as a man avenging his, you know, family or man against the mafia. I mean, there's things you could do. Maybe he's the next cop. Maybe he's a, who knows? I mean, you don't, if there are things that are bothering them about his origin that they don't like, you can alter that, you know?
I feel like the Punisher, there's so much you can do with that character.
Yeah.
But they need to stop treating it like a superhero movie because he's not a superhero. He's not, has any fucking powers.
You're right. He's a vigilante.
He's just a guy with a gun. That's it. Yep.
That's a, it's great. I mean, hopefully the powers that be that, that do the next Punisher installment have that in mind. I mean, yeah, to take him out of that goddamn world. He doesn't even fit in that world anyway. What was the best Punisher comic? Punisher Max, when he had nothing to do with superheroes. It was the main, it was the best. It was the best read.
The Garth Ennis era.
Yeah, the Garth Ennis era. He had nothing to do with any other superheroes. That's how, and it was great. So, you know, from our lips to Hollywood's ears.
Hey, have you read Moon Knight? The new one?
No, I have not read the new one. Moon Knight is a comic that I know has been stopped and started well into the double digits, I think, at this point. And I just never, he never sunk in with me. I don't know. He never got my goat.
Well, the new one is Warren Ellis.
Okay.
So that's why I feel I got to pay attention to that. Because I've loved everything he's done.
That's good.
You know, Iron Man, Extremis, like all that sort of stuff.
No, that was very cool. That was a good, you know, good storyline, I remember from a couple of years back. I have got so into buying vinyl, Mike, that my comic buying has well disappeared for a lot of this year, and I'm going to kind of get back into the groove. I kind of needed a vinyl intervention, and I think I, you know, I gave myself the vinyl intervention, and just looking at my bank account gave me that vinyl intervention. So, yeah, I got to jump back in on the comics horse. I definitely miss it. I just felt like I was getting a little let down by some books too, so I was like, eh, you know.
But Marvel's really been jumping the shark, man. A lot of
I just keep hearing all these bad things about a lot of the Marvel books. I know they ended Daredevil. I was on that run. And now the new one's going to have him in California. Stupid. Oh, my God. What are you doing? Bad idea. I mean, it was like the Constantine. I checked out Constantine number one. Why? Because they ended Hellblazer, one of my favorite comics of all time. And I hated it, so I didn't go back to it. I'll check out this new Daredevil. I'm going to see him in California, and I'm going to tell you, I'm probably going to hate it. So, you know.
I'm not even interested in it. It's like, once Brubaker left, man.
Yeah. I mean, it had such a good run, and it was drawn well, and it was just so cool and exciting. It was so much to look forward to. And Mark Waid, I'm sorry. You suck for Daredevil. There's so many people that have like, what are you talking about? It's great. No, it's not great for Daredevil. He's not good for Daredevil. He's not. I don't even think he gets this character.
No.
It's like he DC'd him somehow. I don't know what he did. He made it just, it's not the same. That edge that was so cool and so prevalent is gone from Daredevil. And I really hope that one day he gets it back with a different writer. But for some reason, the Waid apparently sells well, and I guess the right people think he's the right guy. But I know a lot of other people like you and I, Mike, that think he's terrible for Daredevil. So, you know.
And this is like, he's had many attempts at Daredevil, too.
You know, he's had it for a good couple of years now.
Yeah.
And it's something about it, that factor. Call it an X factor, call it whatever. It's not there. You know?
Yeah.
Like, when someone you really like, a comic you really like, a new writer takes it over, and you give it that fair shot, X amount of issues, and you still aren't with it, that means you're not, you know, you're not going to like it. It's over, you know? And that's kind of how I feel about Daredevil.
Hey, that, and this is going to be more like a local New York thing, I guess, is that place on Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, that's like, I think it's like a fucking pharmacy or something, and they have like, they sell like those action figures there.
Oh, yeah, in Park Slope?
Yeah, what is that place?
Nearguard Pharmacy.
Have you actually ever been to the part that sells the,
the toys?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Is it, how do you get there? Is it upstairs?
Oh, yeah. You got to go inside the store and there's an elevator.
All right. Now, I'm only ever in that part of Brooklyn at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm, yes, yes.
So is that, it's not open?
No. That store is 24 hours, but I believe the toy store portion is maybe 7, 8 o'clock or something like that. Yeah, they have a very nice action figure selection.
Huh. Have you ever bought anything from them?
I think I did when I used to live over there once, twice. I believe I did. They had this tremendous Galactus in
that's
and,
what
yeah,
I was
everybody.
Out, man.
Yeah. And, oh, I actually saw, getting back to RoboCop, they made a big RoboCop. I saw it at Toys R Us.
Do they have it in your guard, you think?
They might, but Toys R Us had it for only $22, so I was like, But I didn't grab it. I should have. yeah, everybody loves the big Galactus toy, man. Those things are the best.
Yeah.
The World Eater. But, yeah, I mean, the thing is, sure, we go off on tangents. We like a lot of crap. Movies, music, comics, but it's all, you know, in the same world for me. It's all kind of intertwined in a way.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, totally. You know, music plays heavily into it. I mean, even if you think about horror movies and...
Sure.
And the soundtracks, you know, Goblin, like all this other stuff, you know, people almost equally... I mean, and also there's a Death Waltz, which is like a label devoted specifically to, you know, reissuing, you know, horror soundtracks horror movie soundtracks.
Yeah, Mondo put out some cool ones recently. They did Blue Sunshine, limited vinyl, and they did Here Comes the Devil, limited vinyl, yeah. And I forget what else they did. I believe someone... oh, no, they did The Omen. That was the third one they did.
Oh, okay.
They did a vinyl, The Omen. So, yeah, very nice. But I believe Death Waltz is going to do a Friday the 13th. If it's not out yet, it's coming soon. I really want that one. I always wanted that on vinyl. I love that music. And yeah, Reanimator one has come out. I mean, this, you know, they're all coming out. I got a very nice Hills Have Eyes one. From the same people who made the Last House on the Left one last year, Light in the Attic. Another cool company. I am waiting for a Cannibal Holocaust vinyl. I don't know. I can't believe that hasn't happened yet. With all that's happened, Riz Ortolani died over the winter. And, you know, one of his biggest soundtracks, aside from Mondo Cane, of course, is the, Cannibal Holocaust. There's a very nice CD, digipack of it out there that you can get, but there's not a vinyl. Hopefully someone makes one.
Well, I think we pretty much hit everything we needed
yes,
to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was cool that you mentioned the Dracula, though. That could be food for thought for the next one. We talk about some of the Dracula movies or talk about one of our favorite Dracula or vampire movies. That would be cool.
Or maybe just vampires, because there's like I think 28 Days of Night is a pretty fucking stellar
absolutely.
Vampire, like a different take on vampires.
30 Days of Night. I mean, yeah.
How did that? Why did I say 28?
Because 28 Days Later is the zombie-esque movie. Yes,
yeah.
And 30 Days.
30
of
Days
night.
Of Night.
No, 30 Days of Night is great.
You know, as I said, 28 Days of Night, I knew I was wrong.
Oh, okay. You know, that's okay. That's what podcasts are for.
I didn't know it was. I forgot that it was 30 days.
Oh, yeah. It's
31 days of night. But, yeah, that... another interesting take on vampires.
Mm. No, totally. I like that take a lot. And before we had started, I said I'd caught The Conjuring, finally, on Blu-ray. And I enjoyed it very much. I can see why it was so successful. It's got a lot of great scares. You know, a fairly bloodless horror movie, more of just a scary ghost, you know, kind of straight story. But it's a pretty cool story, and it's based on a real story. So that always makes it cooler, you know. I still need to see Insidious.
Dude, I hate that movie.
Oh, man, I gotta see it, though.
It's got fucking Darth Maul in it. And
yeah,
it's
weird. Sucks. And then there's a part two, and...
I'm all set, dude.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
But The Conjuring, it's like I got so many mixed reviews about that. Like,
yeah,
so many people are so lukewarm, and some people don't like it, and some people love it.
There were spots where it was like, you know, it was a little, okay, we could cut this out or whatever, not had that. But the overall story I like, And I love the fact that it's about the Warrens couple, who were real life ghost chasers and like probably one of the first, you know, paranormal investigators out there to ever really, you know, get in front of the, you know, the public eye. And this takes place in 71, about 4 or 5 years before Amityville, which was another one of their big cases. And, you know, it has some cool elements to it.
Maybe I think I should, I think it's my duty to see that.
Yeah, check it out. It's definitely worth a rental.
It's got a dark-haired Vera Farmiga.
Yes, too, right? Vera Farmiga. Yes, she's a very, very attractive woman. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Speaking of Vera Farmiga, Bates Motel.
I watched a good chunk of season one, and then I kind of punched out. Yeah. I didn't hate it, but I didn't really love it.
I didn't really. I have like mixed feelings about it. It's kind of fun to watch.
Right. It starts out pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Building an entire series around this is, yeah.
Because what happens, it's like, you know, the kid, the guy who plays Norman Bates is great.
He
the
is
kid,
very good. The kid's he's awesome. Creepy. He's a pretty creepy guy.
And you end up, it's like, I find it hard to believe that you're going to have a series about the guy who turns into a murderer, you know? And, you know, it's an interesting idea, but you know. That
in the original Psycho, you don't really know that much about Mrs. Bates.
Yeah.
Except that she's dead, and she's probably Nutburgers, made her son Nutburgers. And you're okay with that because it's a cool movie, and it's a scary movie, and it's one of those movies where you don't know too much, and that's all good, and I'm fine. Like the original Halloween. We don't know a goddamn thing about Michael Myers, okay? The whole building an entire series around him and his mom is a murderer and an accomplice to the murders and all this stuff. I don't know. Not that into it, right? I mean, it's just, it would be like a TV series about the Myers family.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is like
it's
that.
It's like, would that be that cool? No, it wouldn't.
I have my doubts about it, but then it popped up on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know what, man? I got
no. I think the first bunch of episodes were really good, and then I just kind of, you know, got bored and punched out. Which is kind of what happens a lot with certain TV shows.
Yeah.
With me, but it sure didn't happen with True Detective. I tell you that much.
No,
it did not. But that's gonna do it for the second installment of Necromaniacs. Necromaniacs 2. it's the sequel.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to try to, like, get some kind of web thing going on, like website, you know, because now it's just, you can just go and you can listen to the, you know, stream the podcast or subscribe on iTunes. But, you know, as things kind of develop, I want to, you know, actually get, like, a legit website where we can, you know, have other content.
Yeah, or in the future we can get a guest up here or someone else to talk crap with and, you know, maybe even one of our musician buddies or whoever, you know.
Sure.
Someone from the movie biz.
Just a couple of books, too, man, like a couple of horror. I just finished reading Scott Sigler's trilogy, Infected trilogy.
Yeah, there's a lot of good word of mouth on that. I want to check that out.
Yeah.
I'm reading Joe Hill's Horns. I literally just started it.
How is it?
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. I like the way he writes. I believe there's a movie. It's done. It's in about this. It's in the can already. I think it's coming out sometime this year. So we'll definitely check that out. I punched out of reading his dad's Dr. Sleep.
I was going to ask you about that.
Starts out pretty good, and I don't know what it is. Maybe I just haven't read a Stephen King book in a while, but oof, I was not into it. Although, if a movie of this comes out, or a TV series, whatever, of Dr. Sleep comes out, I'm there. And I'll check it out. And then maybe I'll go back to the book. But the book, some great ideas, but I don't know. I had a complete roadblock at some point. So, maybe check it out. It's the premise is kind of cool, but there's way too many characters. There's way too many characters that don't mean anything to the crux of the story. And that's, in a way, kind of Stephen King's thing, but I don't know. There's some bad reviews. I mean, there's some good reviews of the book out there, but there's also some bad ones. So check them out.
All right. Well, have a good evening,
everyone,
and we'll see you next time.
Later.
I say, fall back the evil way. Oh God, where's the prey? Virgin, the vice decay. Stand forth, life's path. Fall back the evil way. Evil way.
One review says, while it was not a classic, but it is an excellent, intelligent sci-fi drama. One of the boldest Hollywood reboots. Empire Magazine. And Empire Magazine said, this is Sense Padilla, or perhaps his corporate overlords didn't really get what made the original so special. Well, there wasn't a lot of the critique of the day on violence and crime and... there wasn't that kind of smart humor that first one had. You know what I'm saying? Like,
well, I think it was kind of relevant, though. Because
no, it was. But you know how, like, around that time in 87, we could talk about this on the thing, where it was like the time of Morton Downey Jr. and the time of Cops. It was kind of almost like the birth of the in-your-face kind of, like...
reality based.
Reality. It was like the kind of the foundation shit for that. That was, there was a lot of that in the first one. There wasn't really in the second one aside from the Sam Jackson thing. So, yeah. But then again, that's not, it's not new anymore. Like that whole, it's a different.